Welcome to the Fire Upstairs podcast. I'm your host, Joey Gray, and I'm so glad you're here. For a brief period of time in the early 70s, the Upstairs Lounge was a second home to its patrons, a place where they felt safe and free to be themselves in a world that was rampant with discrimination. Then, on the night of June 24th, 1973, someone doused the entrance of the Upstairs Lounge in lighter fluid and struck a match, causing a blaze that would kill 32 people. Until the tragedy at Pulse Orlando in 2016, the Upstairs Lounge was the single deadliest attack on the queer community in the U.S. on record, and it remains one of the deadliest fires in modern New Orleans history. This June, to commemorate the 50th anniversary, we're revisiting the story of the Upstairs Lounge. We'll talk about the fire, but we're also going to talk about what a unique place the Upstairs Lounge was and why it meant so much to so many people. On this episode, I chat with Robert Fiesler, author of Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation. Robert and I discussed how the Upstairs Lounge fits into the larger arc of queer history, what else was happening around the same time, and how did that influence the events leading up to and following the fire. We chat about all this and more. Originally from Chicago, Robert was co-valedictorian at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. In 2019, he was the National Lesbian and Gay Journalist Association Journalist of the Year. He published Tinderbox in 2018. It won the Edgar Award and Louisiana Literary Award. And it was shortlisted for the 2020 William Saroyan International Prize for Writing. After spending several years extensively researching and working on his book, and then countless speaking engagements on the subject since it was released, Robert has become an invaluable source on the Upstairs Lounge. I could have easily talked to him about this all for hours. I hope you'll find our conversation to be as illuminating as I did. So we would love, in your words, as someone who literally wrote the book on the events, to tell us where the fire upstairs sits in the larger arc of queer history and liberation.
Lord in heaven. Well, I mean, that's the question of questions, right? In its day, the Upstairs Lounge fire was this notoriously unsolved arson that took place at a gay bar on the border of the French Quarter, and it claimed 32 lives. It was the deadliest fire on record in New Orleans history. It was the worst mass killing of homosexuals in U.S. history in the 20th century, but it sort of came onto the scene for a few days, and then it fizzled and died in terms of awareness and discussion of it. So in its day, it was this sort of, in New Orleans society, slow-burning ember for local activists who were attempting to revive a story that had been willfully hushed. And then it only through those activists grew over time throughout into the late 20th century and into the 21st century, where it became much more known on a national scale and then an international scale. And it's become this symbol of queer oppression of the 20th century. And it's a symbol of historic ignorance. And it's also a symbol of this present day struggle of what do we do as queer folk, as queer allies with our painful past? Do we utilize it as kind of trauma porn? Do we utilize it as like a gotcha moment against homophobes and queerphobes? Or is it something more? And is it a story of a kind of resilient legacy? Is it a story of finding ways to contextualize pain in the present day in a way that both honors the dead, mourns their loss, and also finds some greater meaning beyond nihilism, especially for queer youth? And that's the struggle. So it went from a terrible calamity in the past that really affected one city to this event that is on like the map of the constellation of major queer events of the 20th century now. That's kind of major.
Yeah. I'm glad that you mentioned the city. You know, it does exist on the world map, but as it was such a small event, right? Such a small and such a local event at the moment of occurrence. So walk me through what day-to-day life was like for the patrons of this bar. Like prior to any of this happening, what are their lives like?
So the Upstairs Lounge was a nice bar on a seedy street that was hidden from street view. So you would have to go up a staircase that was winding where you couldn't even see from the base of the staircase what was at the top. And it was frequented by primarily semi-closeted working class gay men and a few lesbians, but mostly gay men who either grew up in town in a semi-closeted capacity and understood the South's euphemistic way for accommodating dandies, or these were people who grew up in other locations that oppressed them, that then ran to New Orleans as adults to escape their painful past wherever they were from and sort of abandoned whatever identities they had in the past to become themselves in this, again, semi-closeted capacity in what was then considered the queer capital of the South. And most of these people worked typical wage 9-to-5 jobs, and they weren't out at work. These weren't like careerists or super ambitious folk. These were typical New Orleanians that wanted to enjoy the sort of joie de vivre, fun party lifestyle that existed and still exists in New Orleans. And these are people who would perhaps go by another name when they were at the office, their legal name, whatever it was. And then they would have a nickname or an alias or a street moniker that they would then utilize on evenings and the weekends when they would come to the French Quarter and delve into their other identity, which was gay in the queer underworld of the French Quarter. I mean, like, the different bars served different functions, mm-hmm. right? There were senior bars, there were dance discos, there were old school New Orleans daiquiri places, and then there were places like the Upstairs Lounge, which was more of like a sort of gay version of Cheers or something like that, mm-hmm. where you would go to see the same sort of people every day who you'd hang out with and not necessarily bone or try to bone, but like you would just sort of be part of their familial circle and they would know about you and they would know about your work and you would know about them and you'd know about their work. And you would sort of take off the fake invisible layer of clothing involving your straight self that you wore to work and in other aspects of your life. When you walked into the door of the Upstairs Lounge and enter and embrace that sort of oasis atmosphere. And in the Upstairs Lounge, you'd see similar stuff every day. You would see the bartender, Buddy Rasmussen, who would greet you at the door. And there was a white baby grand piano at the far point of the front room where, guess what? A lot of queens, after a few drinks, would get a little sauce and like sit down at the piano and play a few show tunes. And then guess what? Like, one queen can't play show tunes. Others would be wanting to join in. Or there'd be special events. Sometimes they had drag shows mm-hmm. and other kind of performances there, charities, things like that. And people would dance, both like fast dance, the equivalent up to like whatever the 70s version of Bump and Grind would be, and then slow dance too. And then in the third room, they did these special amateur theatrical performances there called Nelly dramas, which was a Southern playoff melodrama, but Nelly was a term for like an effeminate gay man. You weren't there for like the dramatic flair or like someone's acting ability. You were there because these were other people who you knew from the bar who were dressed up like the good guy or the bad guy or, you know, like the femme fatale or like the princess. And then also in that back theater hall room, that's where a local gay-friendly church group called the Metropolitan Community Church would meet. And they met there for about a year and a half to 2 years or so. And then also the back theater hall was where people would do, as part of the MCC Church, Holy Union ceremonies, which were early same-sex marriages, like not legal conjugations, but spiritual ones that were authorized by the Metropolitan Community Church. These were gay couples who loved each other, who would make vows to each other to form families for love and protection.
I'm just thinking about all of these uses for the space. And it's almost like right. calling it a bar is like selling it incredibly short.
Well, right. It's a community clearinghouse, essentially. I mean, like, it was a sort of catch-all for whatever the gay folk that visited the Upstairs Lounge and that loved it needed to use the bar for.
In consideration of all of that and envisioning such an amazing, like, multi-purpose space, how did that happen? It's such a singularity, it seems, for the Upstairs Lounge yeah. to have become that in its time, where outside in the city, elsewhere, where there are gay bars, as you mentioned, it's so different from anything else that existed around it.
Sure. I can't think of any other like egalitarian space like that that could have served as a forefront, like to modern queer safe spaces, where it would sort of be understood that mm-hmm. atmosphere. I would say the bartender, Buddy Rasmussen, like sort of set the pace for what's okay and not okay, and also was pretty easygoing with the rules in terms of what was chill and what wasn't. So for example, there was no sex work permitted inside the Upstairs Lounge, but if you were a sex worker, you were welcome to become part of the community. That wasn't right. considered a big deal. And like similar thing where like gay relations meet race relations is very complicated here, and there was a tremendous amount of gay racism in New Orleans at that time period, and even in the closeted gay underworld of the French Quarter, where if you were on Bourbon Street, and you were Black and especially dark-skinned Black, your ability to access any of the major bars on an ordinary fun, like Saturday night, say, would have been hampered by like racist doormen, mm-hmm. practices where they'd be asking for three or four forms of ID,
yeah,
that kind of thing, and you'd be denied access. Whereas at the upstairs lounge, it was come one, come all. So it was one of the rare environments where you would see Black gay men drinking and conversing and flirting with white gay men, which is now a quite commonplace phenomenon in New Orleans. But back then, it was just like to speak of not known, except in this sort of refuge space. Here's the thing about the upstairs lounge, too. Early gender minorities were welcome, even if they didn't have the terminology we now have. These individuals didn't have oftentimes pronoun awareness. There was like unsure conception of like dysphoria or what have you. It was just known that a person went by a certain name and hung out around the queer scene. In a lot of other New Orleans gay bars, not welcome. But in the upstairs lounge, it was just like, you're part of it. You're part of things. Again, like, it's one of those things where, you know how you can't, like, recreate Woodstock?
Yeah. That's the feeling that I've been getting as you're talking through all this. It feels very 1969 love child, sort of like free, non-judgmental energy. So in terms of beyond those doors, outside those doors, what's being kept out? What's the sort of temperature in the city around them as far as police raids? I know were a huge deal. I would love to hear more about that.
Essentially, as soon as you would descend down like the 13 wooden stairs from the upstairs lounge to Iberville Street, the other world would rush back at you and attack you and oppress you. And that was a world where straight society could have their way with and manipulate and extort and beat down and do all sorts of things to a closeted as well as an openly gay person. It was a place of incredible dangers where if you were a gay man and it became known, you would immediately lose your job and your source of income. You could be terminated because you were participating in what was then a sex crime. If your landlord found out that you were gay, you could be immediately evicted. They would just pack up your stuff into garbage bags and throw it all out into the streets. You would lose your place of residence and become effectively unhoused in that instance, and that creates that instability. If you had a home and you owned it, it could be declared a house of ill repute, and the city could engage practices to remove you from the place that you willfully possessed because of your unsavory moral character. And beyond that, let's say you were walking around, even in the French Quarter, where there was a closeted underworld you could access. You know, if you were around your gay friends, you wouldn't hold hands, certainly. You would be careful how you expressed yourself bodily to each other. You would be noting distance from each other because you could be arrested if you were too close for all, an entire range of harassment crimes that the police had at the ready, such as like obstruction of free passage, which is like legalese for blocking a sidewalk. There were all sorts of ways they could arrest you for any reason. And then if you were trying to access sexually others like yourself, just because you had a hankering to get off or what have you, there were cruising zones, but like those were dangerous because they existed in the secretive underworld settings. There was a place called Cabrini Park in the French Quarter, which was a known spot where you could go meet others for sort of quick, anonymous, hot, let's face it, encounters. But the problem with that was, right, because it's furtive and anonymous, you are consistently, in those instances, subjecting yourself to a degree of danger. There are individuals throughout New Orleans who practice the phenomenon what's called rolling, which is a violent mugging, where you would mug a gay person and beat them down. And then the gay person, essentially manhandled and mangled, wouldn't seek restitution and couldn't seek restitution because their act of seeking restitution for the theft would mean that they had to admit that they were committing a worse crime. And beyond that, there were always a range of sexually conflicted violent assailants. Like, let's say you found someone and you successfully hooked up, and let's say it was good. That doesn't mean that they're not going to go crazy post-orgasm and pull a don't touch me fag, that type of thing.
I would imagine, especially for those who aren't presenting as cisgender, you know?
Correct. And then what happens to that person? And how would that sort of crime be recorded? So there was all this uncertainty that would surround your life. Even if, let's say, you were like just a working class gay man. And what that meant would be take steps to protect yourself on a consistent basis. You would have some sort of plausible deniability between your whatever you lived as your sort of pseudo straight life and your gay life. And you wouldn't want the two to meet. That would mean that you had a gay alias and you would utilize your gay name frequently. That would mean that if you saw a gay friend out in one of your straight locations, you would either pretend not to know the person, or you would pretend not to know them the way you knew them, or you'd ask to be introduced to someone you knew very well.
Is this where that pernicious comment about carrying different IDs came from?
Right.
Or not carrying the right identification?
I think it came from that, but also like in the 70s, no gay folk carried ID. Generally, when they went out to a gay location, because if they were arrested or attacked or if something happened, they wanted to be able to give a fake name to the police at the station, either when they reported the crime or were arrested, so that they could sort of wriggle away from the circumstance and not have what would be the worst circumstance if you were arrested and gay, which is that the police would discover your real name and then your name would be published alongside your alleged crime in the crime blotter of the city's major newspaper of the time period, which was the New Orleans Times-Picayune. And then everyone would see through all your veils and you would suddenly be outed and socially and politically and economically blacklisted. You'd be a dead person walking. And a lot of gay men who were arrested, whose names ended up in the Times-Picayune, suffered tremendously, and some died by suicide.
If you or someone you know is going through a tough time and could use someone to talk to, The Trevor Project is a confidential queer support line that's available for call, chat, or text assistance 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's not an advertisement. That's just an endorsement from someone who's been a volunteer there and who knows firsthand how critical it is to get the help that you need. Their phone number is 866-488-7386. Now, speaking of advertisements, here's a word from our sponsors for this week's episode. Halloween New Orleans is proud to present our 40th anniversary event, HNOXL, a three-day celebration you don't want to miss. On Friday night, immerse yourself in elegance at the Lazarus Ball, a black tie affair featuring a silent auction where you can bid on exclusive treasures while making a difference. Then, on Saturday night, get ready for the main event, the ultimate costume party. Unleash your creativity and let your imagination run wild as you join fellow revelers in an unforgettable night of fun and spectacle. And don't forget about Sunday. Join us for a tea dance celebration and experience the joyous energy of the Second Lion Parade, weaving through the vibrant streets of New Orleans. Throughout the weekend, your participation will support Project Lazarus, providing essential health care and support services for those living with HIV and AIDS. Halloween New Orleans is more than just an event. It's a community that shines with resilience and compassion. Across 4 decades, we have raised nearly $5 million for Project Lazarus, showcasing the incredible power of unity. Save the dates, October 27th to 29th, 2023. HNOXL. Think big, go bigger, and be large. Tickets and passes will be available at HalloweenNewOrleans.com. HNOXL, a celebration where love, showmanship, and a sense of togetherness come alive. Join us and create memories that will last a lifetime. Halloween New Orleans. Together, we shine brighter. Shawn and Val is a men's swimwear brand born from the bond of two best friends. They're committed to creating a community where everyone is welcome. They're inspired by the spirit of the Mediterranean, the history of the gay community, and the simple sophistication of a metropolitan lifestyle. Their mission is to create clothing that makes our community feel comfortable and confident. Shawn and Val is proud to partner with the Hedrick Martin Institute, a nonprofit organization supporting homeless queer youth in New York City. A portion of every sale directly supports Hedrick Martin services year-round.
As you're telling me this about sort of this police climate, I'm just thinking of these parallel timelines, Stonewall happening 4 years prior to the arson at Upstairs Lounge, and just such different relationships established from those two moments. So you think of 1969 Stonewall, New York City, 1973 New Orleans Upstairs Lounge, and the relationship prior to, especially, but then following these events couldn't have been, I think, more different.
Sure.
And I do want you to talk more about that, or maybe why that was, but it seems like to me, the oppression, the sense of oppression carries on after the events of June 24th in New Orleans for a lot of these people, for this whole community. Whereas in the opposite setting in New York City and Stonewall, it's sort of like this, like, no more, we're done.
Well, New Orleans had this other alternate institution and way of accommodating sexual and gender difference, though. It had nurtured and cultivated, right, for decades, if not centuries. And that's a hard tradition to shake, this idea of semi-closetedness, the false notion of live and let live, right? Mm. That we're all going to allow each other to live side by side so long as I do my nasty thing in my corner and you do your nasty thing in your corner, that kind of thing. And that obviously was a ruse that was exposed every time that police raided a gay bar and then arrested gay men and then gave that information to the newspaper, which then printed it, which resulted in consequences for all the gay men. Where's the live and let live there? You know what I mean? But that was a sort of different social institution in like the Paris of the South than say in a place like New York. And so New Orleans had this older sort of system that they thought worked perfectly well. If you were outed, right, you became the equivalent of a bum. You were not respected anymore. You could be successful and sort of semi-closeted and self-homophobic. And that was the avenue that a lot of people were given,
right,
and the avenue that they took. And they interpreted that as freedom. And so the idea of a public gay activist was viewed as a threat then. Because if you had someone that's like out and gay and they're showing their face on TV and they're using their real name, they're screwing up everything that you feel that you've built to become successful in this city that you love and don't intend to leave. And they're sort of violating everything you thought was appropriate as a gay man. And so there was straight society that was oppressing gay folk. There was also the upper crust elite of gay New Orleans society mm-hmm. that would then oppress the activist folk. And that went on into the 70s and 80s. It takes a long time to shake that kind of an institution that people had been taught was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
The owner of the Upstairs Lounge, Phyllis Steve, into the 1970s would try to make the argument that there's no gay activists in New Orleans because none are needed.
Right, right. I'm just thinking of that famous or maybe infamous line that he's attributed as saying after the fire, he basically, in so many words, tells people not to come and make it a gay rights issue.
Right.
So basically, like, let it go. I mean, it just speaks to everything you've just described. But it seems sort of like everyone sort of made this mutually agreed social contract. Like,
yeah,
even though it wasn't really a mutual agreement and it really didn't serve both bodies at all.
No, but the social compact was presented always as the most viable option because it was the thing that somebody knew. And so when there were instances where the gay community rose up or organized or what have you, such as like in the 50s, during one of the Mardi Gras, there was a riot and then there was a gay bar called Dixie's and there was a little bit of participation and there's debate whether or not there was like a proto-gay riot where the gays got involved in this riot against the cops in the 50s. And then in the early 70s, there was a small, short-lived contingent of the Gay Liberation Front that after a police raid on that one gay cruising zone I talked to you about called Cabrini Park, where many of the cruisers were violently beaten down, the Gay Liberation Front protested City Hall and demanded a meeting with the mayor, Moon Landrieu, who refused to meet with them, but he sent down his assistant, who then met with the gay leadership, and then they met with the police chief, and they negotiated a cessation of gay bar raids that went on for like 3 years.
Mm.
So like success, right? You would think, and this would lead to more of the Gay Liberation Front being active in New Orleans. But because it was like a behind the scenes success, the gay elite were able to present that to the rest of gay society as failure. And the point that like gay politicization was pointless. You see, it didn't work. And then after the Upstairs Lounge, again, there were attempts and steps towards activism and public visibility that achieved some amount of success that then were beaten down again by the system and the social order. So it took a couple different times of people slowly rising up, getting beaten down, slowly rising up, getting beaten down. And the Upstairs Lounge was just another one of those steps where it hadn't hit like ignition, where after Stonewall, there seems to have been a tremendous outpouring and a sort of political transformation. People got militant.
Yeah.
People got militant. And the sort of militancy in queer New Orleans did happen post Upstairs Lounge for some people, but it wasn't for the mass. It was for like the niche, a few select people who became very important. And the Upstairs Lounge is just part of that story, I think, was part of the story of them taking steps to break free, but it wasn't the moment where everyone unleashed.
Hearing all of this, I just, you know, I hadn't had this thought previous, but it seems like because it was such a closely held experience, like it was such a private sort of community for the most part for the few years that it was in existence, the fact that that wasn't shared or witnessed by anyone really outside of that world, to me, that indicates that it almost would have changed some minds perhaps, but it feels like it exists in such a container, in such a guarded space that of course nothing was going to change outside of that space, which is twofold, right? It's sad because you think of all the progress that could have come from that. And it's also really lovely to think about there even being that space to exist at all for any of these people. You mentioned that following the fire and the people that did try and step up again to rise to the occasion, regardless of circumstances surrounding, you know, attitudes in the atmosphere. What's life like in the immediate aftermath of this for the people who were patrons of the Upstairs Lounge?
It's variable, right? There was this sort of window of space where a lot was possible. The Upstairs Lounge fire was this literally explosive emergency, a moment that attracted the entire attention of the city. Almost all of the city's emergency workers and police and firefighters, hundreds of onlookers are aware of this event as it's happening. And then in the hours that follows, there's a sort of political awakening among gays who cry out for help and realize they have no leadership to help them manage this emergency moment, knowing that there's no central community structure, there's no activist system, there's no viable leader even who could step forward and speak for the community following this calamity. And so there was like a phone tag sort of thing where a person calls one MCC minister, John Gill, who's in Atlanta, who then calls another MCC minister, who eventually calls the founding pastor of the Metropolitan Community Church, who is an activist himself named Troy Perry in Los Angeles, and he becomes alerted to the fire within hours after it happening. And then, of course, Troy Perry has all sorts of political contacts through his work with founding the gay-affirming Metropolitan Community Church, which is by then a national church that has many different chapters throughout many different cities. So he then calls the gay leadership he knows, and he reaches Morty Manford, who's in New York City, who is with the Los Angeles Gay Community Center leader, Morris Kite, and they all decide they're going to descend upon New Orleans, like in the next few days. Like a lot of times that day, they buy the ticket and they fly down. And New Orleans had never experienced something like that before, where all of a sudden gay leadership is present, and they decide to gather close to the fire site. These gay leaders get a room in the Marriott Hotel, which is the closest hotel, like literally across the street from the ruins of the Upstairs Lounge. And when they arrive, the Upstairs Lounge vestiges of it are still smoking, actually. And so they do what had never been done before, which is they invite the press to a ballroom and they hold a press conference. And Troy Perry shocks all the local queens by using his real name and showing his face and giving New Orleans a lecture about them having to join the rest of the union in terms of gay rights.
Not everybody loved that.
I know. They did not. He's just like a bucking bronco unleashed. So he's stepping up and he's seeing individuals who perished in the fire not being allotted the respect they deserve. He sees a joke of a police investigation. He sees families not stepping forward to either tend to the individuals who were injured in the fire or to claim the victims. And he's irate, okay, reasonably so. And he decides to lecture New Orleans about it. And then he gets involved and he sort of peremptorily becomes the leader, right? He's not from New Orleans, but he's like, I'm going to be a sort of attention rod and I'm going to go everywhere around town and I'm going to tell people about this fire, not let them forget about it, not let them speak about it in hushed tones. I'm going to tell them I'm a gay minister and I'm going to be wearing like a Roman collar when I tell them that. He attends and preaches sermons at several different memorial services for the Upstairs Lounge victims. He attempts to meet with city leadership and the mayor. He attempts to meet with local gay leadership, the individuals who run the gay bars who are upset that he's in town. And he has a back and forth with them. He attempts to get in touch with the Archbishop of New Orleans to try to have St. Louis Cathedral, the local basilica, used.
Well, I'm sure for him, it seems like that would be the obvious thing to do.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, he's getting nothing but closed doors oftentimes. He's this amazing leader who then is sort of inspiring locals too in turn. So there are individuals who survived the Upstairs Lounge fire who sort of become part of Troy Perry's entourage then, like Ricky Everett. They call them the National Emergency Task Force. As they go around town and as they try to revive interest in the fire that as it's dying, like minute by minute, they're seeing people not wanting to talk about it or talk about it in inappropriate contexts.
And this is within days, just to be clear. This
Correct.
Is the same week of the events.
This is the same week. And it all leads up to and culminate in a very large memorial service that's held at a very important civil rights church on the border of the French Quarter called St. Mark's on Rampart Street, where about 300 semi-closeted New Orleanians turn up, pack the place to the rafters, and collectively mourn the Upstairs Lounge dead, which was a big thing to happen. Let's say that that was all that occurred. this 300 closeted gay people were together in a religious space, acknowledging this queer tragedy that had just happened and admitting to each other they knew someone who died in the fire, as opposed to the plausible deniability you discussed, the people who wouldn't admit that they knew at work. That was a big deal in itself. And this is like, what, a week, right? July 1st is like 7 days from June 24th, the event of the fire. So that's transformational. That's like the largest gathering of gay folk in New Orleans. It shouldn't be. I mean, technically, right. If you want to go to like one of the typical like Mardi Gras balls, I'm sure back in the day there were more closeted gay men at those, but they weren't out right to each other even. Some of them were literally masked. So in this case, these are people who are unmasked in the light of day meeting each other and acknowledging their common grief and they're finding ties together and common cause. And it's this beautiful service. Troy Perry preaches a sermon where he connects the upstairs lounge fire to the broader Stonewall gay liberation legacy. And then he gets down and there's other people who are preaching. And then Troy Perry, in this controversial, dramatic moment that people swear was something he totally made up or was a stunt. But anyway, he runs back to the front of the church. And he says, I know I promised you all that television news cameras wouldn't be here, that you'd be able to grieve in private, but the news stations have arrived and they've set up cameras out front on Rampart Street. And I'm so sorry, but you're all going to be outed when you leave. So if any of you need this and can't exit by the front door, I could offer you a side door escape hatch for anyone who wants to slink back into the corridor, essentially. And then like a commotion ensues in the church. And people are debating about, should we go? Should we take the cameras away from the people? Is Troy Perry lying to us? And this is just some sort of, you know, the equivalent of like an Al Sharpton stunt or something like that. And then this woman who's only remembered now as like a butch lesbian, no one can identify her to this day, stands up in the balcony and she says, I came in through the front door and I'm damn well leaving that way. And then other people cheer in response to her spontaneously. And then everyone sort of stands up and then they collectively move out the front doors of the St. Mark's Church onto Rampart Street, ready to face the cameras, ready to out themselves to the world. And there were several people who became very important gay New Orleans activists who were part of that moment of that surge that happened when the woman spoke and they walked out the church onto Rampart Street. One was Charlene Snyder, who opened a very important lesbian bar called Charlene's that was the major political center for queer New Orleans for years. And then an upstairs lounge survivor named Stuart Butler also walked out the front door. He became like a multi-decade long activist for gay rights and also early trans rights. And that was important. And they're together in the light of day, walking out, embracing their identities. And it was this massive, victorious moment for the people who participated in it. And then for years, people in New Orleans chipped away at that memory. They tried to say, oh no, the television cameras weren't there. Oh no, Troy Perry was just pulling off a facade. He wanted to make you think you were outing yourself when you hadn't outed yourself.
You were tricked into pride. You were tricked into bravery.
Right. I thought that doesn't sound right. So I went and I found the camera logs of the news stations who'd set up outside the church. And it says like outside French Quarter Church for Memorial. Like this camera was there. The TV cameras were present. So then I had to present that evidence. And even now there are local New Orleanians who are like, well, yeah, but were the cameras recording? Or, oh no, they'd taken it down. Like they try to chip away at this moment that was, I think, a moment of pure liberation that happens 1 week in direct response to the upstairs lounge tragedy.
Yeah, that's the inflection point for me when I picture this story for sure. This sort of like sunlight pouring on these like dark and shadowy spaces and faces in this one collective moment of unity absolutely is the point of political shift, as I imagine it.
This is how I think of it too. And people who try to downgrade that moment or say it wasn't that important that 250 to 300 queer folk did that, I don't know what basis you have. Our future political victories are built off of that kind of an enough is enough moment. And you can draw the line, and I have, directly through that to other things that happened, to other moments of political awakening and political activity for the local queer community that are built off of that St. Mark's Church moment.
Are you referring to Anita Bryant?
Well, a couple different things happened, but like, so there was a local journalist named Bill Rushton, who was known to be gay, but he wrote for a newspaper called the Vieux Carré Courier. He was an editor. It was a local alt-weekly in the French Quarter. And Bill Rushton had some of the most excellent and sympathetic coverage of the upstairs lounge tragedy in 73. But Bill Rushton also became a well-known gay national journalist, where he wrote some of the upstairs lounge stories that were then placed in an early ragtag magazine that was operating in Los Angeles called The Advocate. And a lot of that Upstairs Lounge coverage was Bill's. So Bill became not just this like detached journalist individual, but he became politically incensed about what he was seeing. So Anita Bryant does her thing in Miami-Dade County, where there's this recall vote where essentially they put it on the ballot to strike down this anti-discrimination ordinance that local gay folk had put forward to protect gay people in employment, housing, public accommodations. That got struck down. And Anita Bryant, in her exuberance, sort of kicks off from Florida this national anti-homosexual, anti-gay movement. And she comes to New Orleans in 77, and she meets an opposition. And the people who are in opposition are organized in this group called Human Equal Rights for Everyone. Gay groups always love these acronyms. So it stood for HEAR, Human Equal Rights for Everyone.
HEAR and queer, I get it.
Yeah, that had unified, right, to oppose Anita Bryant, who was having a concert at the municipal auditorium. And the individuals who were organizing and leading the Anita Bryant rally included, right, Bill Rushton and also Charlene Snyder. So there were two individuals who were tied in with the Upstairs Lounge legacy who were present and central to the Anita Bryant protest. Charlene was the parade grand marshal. So there was a massive protest in Jackson Square in front of St. Louis Cathedral, where the leader of HEAR speaks, and then Leonard Matlevich speaks, and then like Bruce Vohler and Frank Kameny, all these major gay liberation leaders speak. The crowd hasn't had enough. They decide they want to take their demonstration to Anita Bryant directly. Charlene is the parade grand marshal, and she corrals them all, and they all march down St. Ann Street through the French Quarter, and then they get to the municipal auditorium, and they sort of arrange themselves around it, and they chant, like, we're here, we're all this, like, out of the closets, into the streets, all that stuff. And their cheering is so loud that it interrupts and prevents the Anita Bryant concert inside, because like they can't hear Anita singing because the protesters are so loud outside. And that moment is massive. That's 3,000 gay folk that are gathered there, right? But the people who are most out and visible, the people who are giving all the quotations to the news media, a lot of those are individuals, right, who were incensed or who were sparked into activism by the Upstairs Lounge tragedy, such as Charlene, such as Bill Rushton.
The way you retell the story is very visual, so I'm just imagining all of these scenes in my mind as you go on, and it's very inspiring now, although I can't imagine at the time, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, so there's the folks that are injured and not perished in the fire. There are the loved ones and the partners that were left behind, the children of patrons. And so like all of this sort of like rush of political action and liberation is happening. Maybe not a rush, maybe a trickle in this case, because it was taking years.
Yeah. And that stuff's hard to sustain, right? Especially if you're not used to political organizing.
Right.
And like at the end of like, let's say the week after the Upstairs Lounge tragedy, you have this remarkable moment at the memorial. Well, then they're going to have to take time for grieving too. And that's going to take years.
That was my question. What are these folks doing during all of this? It's beautiful to think about someone like a Suet Butler being in those fights, you know, continuing on for years as he did. But then there's the others that maybe just didn't have it in them or didn't want to at that point be forced out or have to live a politically charged life. Can you speak to those experiences at all?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of them tried to disengage from that sort of politicization afterwards, and really were trying to deal with and manage the psychological consequences of surviving the fire or of losing close people to them in this span of minutes, and also managing the tremendous, tremendous survivor's guilt that they felt. It doesn't make sense that they're alive and someone they loved isn't, because of what happened in like a split decision that they made within 30 seconds after fire was in the first room of the Upstairs Lounge about what direction to run. What was their instinct? What did they overhear in that pandemonium? It didn't make sense to them. And so people who lost lovers, people who lost very close friends, couldn't quite, it's not like they received any sort of mental health care or any sort of lasting support from the state or even any spiritual enterprise, right? So these are individuals who are not speaking to counselors, who've experienced a tremendously traumatic thing, who either force delete or forget or suppress a lot of the carnage they witnessed as a way of moving on and just being able to embrace even a sort of workaday life, or they fall into religion very hard and need to frame what happened to them within the context of some sort of deity that had a plan and it all made sense to them. Or they fall back into this idea of the semi-closeted underworld that gave them such comfort prior to the fire, and they revert to whatever they had known before, hoping that that will provide the same amount of succor that it once did, although it won't. And a good example of that would be the Upstairs Lounge bartender, Buddy Rasmussen, right? Buddy Rasmussen lost his lover, Adam Fontenot, in the Upstairs Lounge fire, even though he was able to bravely manage to save, you know, 30 to 40 patrons within the bar, like more than half of the people that were inside of it. And via split-second decisions, he still couldn't manage the overwhelming weight and grief and pain of not being able to save everyone, and especially not being able to save his lover. And so over time, it wasn't helpful for him to continually revisit the Upstairs Lounge.
Would you say that the legacy of the Upstairs Lounge is twofold? At least it seems like there's these two offshoots of this sort of forced reckoning of identity, as well as this political awakening that others had. What is the legacy? What are the legacies of the Upstairs Lounge and the events that happened?
Well, the legacy was 32 people died in a terrible calamity due to no fault of their own. And then they were disrespected in death. And then they were erased. And they were erased because they were gay. It was this terrible story of an event that people suppressed talk of in the immediacy of it. There's that reality. Then there's this small mustard seed, this slow burning ember of people who refuse that narrative, who refuse that nihilism and the darkness and the void of it, and talk about it and spread the word, and want people to know about their friend who died in this fire, who wasn't just remarkable because he died in a fire, right? He was remarkable because he'd lived 42 years before, and here's a story I want to tell you about him, and he was funny. And eventually that legacy overtakes the nihilism and the erasure. And that's powerful. The notion that, for me anyway, that the love people had for the individuals who died in the Upstairs Lounge fire eventually overcame and beat out the pain that suppressed talk of them is astounding. It's an astounding expression of like the triumph of human will and goodness. The idea that no cause is lost, right? Till time ends, right? As long as someone is there who is willing to revive the story in a way that people can connect to, that's powerful. And so I think that's, in the end, the legacy of the Upstairs Lounge, which was the tragedy itself, which is always going to be a weight. And it's always an instance of oppression and the desire to erase queer folk in this world and to deny our pain and to deny the fact that anti-queer messaging produces violence from within and without the community. That's almost a direct consequence of that messaging. There's that, right? The tragedy itself. And then there's the legacy, which is trying to, in a meaningful way, honor the lives who were lost, to maintain the story and intensity on the story such that we never forget the violence of the Upstairs Lounge tragedy, and then also finding some way to, in a transformative way, memorialize the fire in a way that it connects with people emotionally today, such that you can make all the emotional turns you need to be able to understand what it was like to be gay or lesbian in the French Quarter in the early 1970s when someone couldn't fully be themselves. And me personally interacting with the Upstairs Lounge story has been one of the most profound things in my life. Like even now, I researched the book for 4.5 years. This book came out 5 years ago. I still get people every day emailing me with their shock about having just found out.
Why do you think it seems that the importance of the fire at the Upstairs Lounge has gained more and more over time?
Because the legal power of the closet failed at the federal level. And that resulted in all sorts of ramifications in terms of state and local and just from a social context, queer folk being able to interact and to announce their truth and be themselves in this society. And then there's been a backlash to that powerful thing that happened just over a course of a few decades. Tremendous cultural transformation of us all walking into the light and saying who we are. And the Upstairs Lounge is a mechanism and a way to respond to the backlash, I think. In essence, to remind folk that are putting forward very hurtful ideological messages, wanting to hedge in queer folk and take us out of the public space and push us back into the shadows. And it reminds us that queer pain is real, right? That queer families are just families, and that there are real consequences for asking us to be secret.
Tinderbox is available everywhere books are sold. And you can find Robert on Twitter and Instagram at WordBobby. On our next episode, I chat with actor, writer, producer, singer, and drag superstar Ben de la Creme. We talk about the importance of queer spaces. and we get into the recent drag bans that we've seen popping up across the country. Dale and I discuss the importance of fostering our community and how we, as queer people, pass our culture down through generations. I'd like to say thank you for listening to the Fire Upstairs podcast and staying with us this far. This show is brought to you by Provincetown Brewing Company, Mullen and Getz, Sean and Val, Double Scorpio, and Halloween New Orleans. The Fire Upstairs podcast is produced by Ryan Killian Krause and edited by Citizens of Sound. I'm your host, Joey Gray. I'll talk to you soon.